This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 139, Quiet Before the Storm. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Star Trek Online's 9th season, Roberto Orci's hopes for the next Star Trek film, the finale of Enterprise's Blu-ray release, and the independent film Star Trek Horizon. Then in the feature, we're joined by Michael Fisher and Von Glitschka to discuss the DS9 episode, The Sound of Her Voice. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. It is great to have you on the Ready Room with me again. It has been way too long. I forget how long it's been because you and I do two other shows together every single week. But not only do I have you back on the Ready Room, but I have you back here for a DS9 episode, which is what I try to do every time we come around. But it never works out.
You know, it just doesn't, Chris. I do feel like it's just been ages and ages, and I have missed the Ready Room, the crown jewel, the creme de la creme, the piece de la resistance for the Trek FM network, and so it is great to be back here. I feel like, I'm always holding up, you know, the palatial Dallas studios of Trek FM, and when I'm on the Ready Room, I feel like I need to pull out my golden microphone, you know, to really make it official. It'd be great though, Chris, if we would get those golden microphones you were supposed to send us.
I know, I'm working on that one. Yeah. I've got a deal I gotta make. Quark's helping me out with some Denevan crystals. If that comes through, we'll have enough latinum
okay.
by the microphone.
Okay, so. That makes sense.
All right. I also noticed today, Matthew, it's, you know, we're in spring now. We're heading towards May. Must be warming up there in Dallas. I notice you're in shorts and short sleeves today. And that makes me think about Starfleet. They need to have sort of warm weather uniforms. I think back to the old Saturday Night Live sketch, Love Boat, The Next Generation, when Patrick Stewart was on and they had the Love Boat sailor outfits that looked like Starfleet uniforms. I think that's something we need to get going.
Yeah. I think that might be a thing, Chris. You know, they did have it briefly on The Next Generation with the sport squirt thing that men were wearing, you know, just like the women, you know, those dresses.
Oh, the scant. The scant.
Yeah, exactly. There. Yeah. That's what I meant, Chris. So shockingly enough, that was the only time it seems like their foray into warm weather wear. And
it
so I'm a little
like
disappointed.
It.
And actually not really their best job on, you know, honestly.
No. Not at all. So I'm picturing like white Bermuda shorts with the colored tops. That's what would look fantastic.
Something like, you know, when Archer goes to meet Hoshi when she's teaching, you know, and he's got the, you know, the nice linen shirt on, you know, something like that.
Something like that. Yeah, that would work. All right. Well, let's jump into the news here. We have four news stories today before we get to the feature. And the first one relates to the Abrams verse. Matthew, I know that you are a fan of the J.J. Abrams Star Trek 2009, especially Into Darkness. And of course, Roberto Orci was involved in pinning those together with his writing partner, Alex Kurtzman. And the story we have here is sort of a two-in-one. The first development here is the fact that Orci and Kurtzman are going to be going their separate ways. They've been writing together since the late 90s when they were writing the TV series Hercules. They've also written Transformers, Mission Impossible 3. On TV, they've written Alias, Fringe, Hawaii Five-0. They've also written Sleepy Hollow and Spider-Man 2, which is coming up. And they're finally going to go their own ways, although they're going to keep their joint production house, KO Paper Products, going. And so that's the first bit here. What do you think about this part of the story?
You know, I thought it was interesting. And the most interesting thing about it is that they're going their separate ways because they'd like to be able to direct more. And I think they've been so busy writing for so many films that they have kind of allowed their directorial status to kind of slide. And both of them would like to have more forays into that. And so I wish them all the best of luck in that. You know, these guys, whether you love them or not, I mean, I enjoyed the original Transformers. Mission Impossible 3 was fantastic. Alias was a great show. Fringe was enjoyable as well. You know, I enjoy, the first Spider-Man, the Amazing Spider-Man. I liked it a lot. Obviously I enjoyed Star Trek and Star Trek and Darkness. And so, these guys do definitely, I think, usually craft, relatively good films, you know, and well done TV shows. And so, I'm excited to see them kind of grow their own craft separately. And so, I think it'll be most interesting because, you know, this is also, Roberto Orci is seeking to direct Star Trek for 2016, which,
yeah.
I don't know, Chris, what do you think about that?
Well, that was the other angle of the story. And yeah, as you mentioned, they're splitting partially because they would like to direct more. So yeah, Roberto Orci is reportedly, this has been reported by Variety that he is seeking to direct the next Star Trek film, which of course all the media calls Star Trek 3. I can't bring myself to call it Star Trek 3. So we call it Star Trek 2016. And also reportedly, Paramount is eyeing him with caution, I guess, because this would be his directorial debut. I don't know that you want to put someone out there for the third in this very lucrative series of Star Trek films behind the camera for the very, very first time. Although if you're going to do it, having it be the person who's going to be writing the film together with Patrick McKay and J.D. Payne, and who wrote the last two films as well, might be the safest route to that.
Well, and see, you know, I was thinking, Chris, is that the consistency then with what J.J. had done would probably be very close.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's been involved in writing all three films and really kind of understanding their, you know, core more than anybody else. I could really see this being something that worked well to have him as director. And as long as he has a good assistant director and editor, I think that's going to be really important, obviously, in the film because, you know, the way that JJ edits, is very distinctive. And, you know, I believe that JJ is going to be executive producing Star Trek.
I think so. Yeah.
And so at least that influence there will be. And so I don't see this as being a bad thing. You know, I really see this as being the best way to be consistent with the other two films while at the same time maybe branching off into a new direction because I cannot see the fact that Paramount would want this series to end anytime soon. It has been a lucrative adventure for them. They've made a lot of money. And I think the goal here in this third Star Trek and the JJ verse is really to just make a better film, you know, in the sense of, okay, let's not be tied to any kind of canon. Let's go out there and do what this new universe allows us to do, which is explore it in a way that we haven't explored the other universe. And so hopefully that's where we'll go.
You know, with JJ being the executive producer, I wonder if Roberto Orci were the director, if it would be a way, like you say, to maintain consistency, but I can see it as a way of, at least at some point along the way, JJ having input over the look and feel of the film that he wouldn't have with another director coming in who would probably want JJ to be hands off. He would want this to be his own thing. The relationship that Orci has with JJ is such that there probably would be some collaboration going on some level.
But which is true, although JJ's going to be up to his eyeballs in Star Wars at this point.
Yes, that's by true. That, but still.
By that point, yeah. But I can definitely see they're, and especially the idea of JJ looking at everything, the production design, all
that's
that kind of stuff.
That's what I'm talking about for.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be very close to what we've already gotten.
Yeah.
The production design obviously grew in Into Darkness. We saw that with new corridor sets, with the new warp core, things like that. Which thank God they gave us a new warp core that didn't look like a freaking brewery. So dumb. But
well, I'm waiting for the Cetacean Ops set in the next movie.
Yeah, I think that would be fantastic. You know,
I want to see Abrams first Cetacean Ops. Yeah.
I'm just looking, where are the really, like, where does Keenzer live? Does he have, like, a hobbit hole? See, you know, like,
you want to see, you know, Keenzer's quarters?
Exactly. He runs out of his hobbit hole. I'm going on an adventure! You know, like, because he's running down to meet Scotty in engineering. So who knows? I mean, there's all sorts of ways this could go. And I think we've given them some great ideas, Chris.
I think so.
Hopefully they're listening.
So we'll see if this comes to fruition or not. I would think that we would probably be finding out sometime in the coming months which way they're going to go. Variety reports that the film is supposed to lens this summer in like June. So if that's the case, they need to start getting the team kind of solidified a little bit. So. All right. Well, we'll put a link in the show notes anyway to that story over on 1701 News if you'd like to find out a little bit more. Our next story here is about Star Trek Online. And on April 23rd, which was last Wednesday as we're recording this, they launched Season 9, A New Accord, which features Tim Russ reprising his role as Tuvok. And it also features the Undine, who most fans know better as Species 8472. From Voyager. Matthew, you've been in the game, you've been playing a bit right now. Have you actually taken part in any of the Season 9 elements yet?
I have not, Chris. I'm actually, you know, because I just started not too long ago, I'm actually in like the first season.
Okay. So you're going to go straight through all.
Yeah. I haven't gotten a chance to play in quite a while. There's been way too much going on in life to just get down and unfortunately play a game that I have enjoyed. But this is really cool.
You know, this is why they need to make a tablet client for this, right? Because if you had on your iPad,
yes,
then you could play on the bus, on the train.
Oh my God, I would never do any reading and
that's right.
It would be pathetic. I could really see this doing well there. But I gotta say, and just alone them putting on a Mac, they got a huge response.
Yeah.
And the game really is, it's a relatively beautiful game. The space combat is fun.
As I've said before on here, I can't play. I'm in Japan and we are banned by Perfect World. The entire country, almost all of Asia is banned by Perfect World from playing Star Trek Online for some reason.
Yeah, that does not make sense. But this is exciting. I mean, you're going to get brand new kits. You're going to have brand new Earth space dock. You're going to get all sorts of amazing things. You're going to get Tim Russ is Tuvok showing up. And in fact, I didn't even know this. Hey, I'm just playing season one and, you get to meet Bones and Scotty from the original series in one of the episodes, that you end up playing, which is really fun. So all of these kind of things, they show up in the game and you're just not really necessarily expecting it. And it's a lot of enjoyment there. It is a game that you can really just pop in and out of, you know, and play a few missions and then, you know, you not play for a while and play back, you know. So that's what's really nice about it. So for those though that have already been playing the game and they're ready for new missions, this is really exciting. So, and they put a lot of hard work into this, I have to say. So, if you're not playing, go ahead and join. It's free. You do not have to pay anything to really enjoy the game. I don't pay at all. And I still really enjoy playing the game. There's nothing like flying around right now as I am, a Constitution refit Enterprise style, you know, ship and just being the crap out of things. It's awesome. it's as close as it gets, you know, to having your own starship. Right. So,
and the great thing about Star Trek Online too, besides flying around beating the crap out of things, is that they have diplomatic missions as well. So you can really take part in everything related to Star Trek, both space combat as well as diplomacy. Now, we mentioned that Tim Russ is going to be here in season 9 as Tuvok. He appears in the featured episode Surface Tension, which continues the story of Sphere of Influence and A Step Between Stars. And this sends gamers to the Delta Quadrant and beyond to combat the Undine threat. And so, again, I can't get in the game to find out. I assume to the Delta Quadrant and beyond maybe is referring to fluidic space, perhaps. And speaking of Tim Russ, by the way, I just had him on my other show, Continuing Mission. I had Tim on to talk about Star Trek Renegades. Episode dropped this week. So if you want to hear more from Tim Russ about Tuvok, because he's reprising the role of Tuvok in Renegades as well, check out that episode of Continuing Mission. As for season 9 here, though, things that you can expect, updated Borg and Undine missions, Undine assault, ship captains can enter battle to defend well-known planets, Ferenginar, Andoria, Gornar, Cardassia from Undine Attack can help stop planet killers from decimating the Alpha and Beta Quadrants. Also, you can bring the fight to the Undine with mixed faction teams to enter fluidic space. There you go. And eliminate Undine ships before they are fully constructed. There's also an Undine Dyson Sphere battle zone. This is kind of the cool stuff that you can do in the video game, right, Matthew?
Definitely. I mean, it's an area once controlled by the Voth, so that's pretty exciting.
That's pretty cool. The dinosaur race from Voyager.
Exactly. You know, and like I said earlier, you know, they're going to have a brand new Earth space dock, and that's a very cool thing. The original space dock has been there, I think, since the beginning of the game, so they're completely redesigning that, a new remodel of the Earth space dock. So that's cool. And then the new kit systems, and they've been completely updated for you. So they really have been really working hard on the game, and I think it'll be well worth all the fans to get in there and get excited about season 9.
Yeah, definitely. So go check it out if you're in the game already. You know what to do. If you're not, you want to find out a little bit about it, we'll put a link in the show notes as well. Another story over on 1701 News with all kinds of information about STO Season 9. All right, Matthew, the next story is very close, very dear to our hearts. Enterprise Season 4 finally dropping on April 29th, which is, for me, tomorrow as we're recording. I have already had it on pre-order since March 20th. I can't wait for it to get here. And it's hard to believe because, you know, we talked when they were trying to do cover art for the Enterprise Blu-ray release. I remember talking about that story, and here we are tomorrow. We're going to be done with it. All of Enterprise is going to be available on Blu-ray now.
Chris, it's crazy to me. I mean, oh gosh. This is the season too for me that every time I watch it, I lament the fact that Enterprise ended. It boggles my mind. I'm sad when I get to the end. There's the episode that shall not be named as well. That happens, that I don't even want to think about as well. and so what I'm really excited about this set though is that they're gonna have a conversation about writing Enterprise, and it's part of the Before Her Time Decommissioning Enterprise, a 4-part series. And so really getting all these writers together and talking about all these different things that they talked about. They even released a 1-minute clip on StarTrek.com, which was so fascinating to watch these guys just kind of get together and reminisce and kind of talk through the season. And the clip was about what they had done with the Vulcans and how much the writers really liked it. And they couldn't understand why so many people were kind of up in arms with showing us a progression of the Vulcans as if they were always perfect, you know, like as right. If humans were always that way. Again, I'm with them, the writers. I don't understand it. I think it was a fantastic way of actually helping us know something about a race that we had been watching forever. I mean, you watch the original series. We know very little about Vulcans and their history.
Right.
Spock.
You know about Spock. That's pretty much it. And you know that they fight over women. And
which is weird, but I mean, that's fine. Apparently they haven't really evolved that much. So it was so great in Enterprise to really get that idea of what this race was like, in the same way about the way they did with the Andorians and a little bit with the Tellarites, really exploring these races. And so, you know, having this set, I think is going to be fantastic. I have the other three. I'm very much looking forward to this. The extras have been hands down fantastic.
They have been.
And I have to say, I've liked most of the extras on the Next Generation Blu-rays, but I felt like the season, I think it was 5, were a little bit lackluster for me. Some of the ones they felt disjointed and just not as well put together, but all the Blu-ray Enterprise documentaries have been incredible. So if you don't own these, go out and get them. Just keep watching Amazon to put them on sale, because they're so worth it for these extras. And the episodes look bloody brilliant. So you need to go out and get these. Yeah,
the extras on the Enterprise discs are fantastic. And I think it's partially because with the Next Generation, we've known so much about that show because there are so many years that have gone by, and because it was, you know, produced at a time where it really had... It was a perfect scenario, especially after they got past the first couple of seasons, you know, to produce a show. And Enterprise had such a rocky run, and then we didn't know very much of what was going on. And now we're finding out. And this one here, so the setup of this in conversation writing Star Trek Enterprise, if you've seen the panel with the actors and with Brandon Braga from the season 2 set, I believe it's on, it's very much the same setup as that. I almost think this one's going to be even more interesting, especially from the clip that StarTrek.com has, because Brandon is more in his element with his fellow writers than with the actors. You know, there was sort of this rift, I feel, between the producers and the actors, which I guess it's just kind of natural because they're each doing their own thing on the show. But here, because these guys were working so closely together in the writer's room, I can't wait. That 1 minute clip was fantastic, and I can't wait to find out everything they talk about.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, even just watching it and kind of watching them all kind of bounce off each other, you know, Brandon says something, David Goodman just kind of interrupts, you know, they're all very comfortable together. And, you know, Garfield, Reese Stevens, is, you know, it just, everybody is in their element here, and they're all, I feel like, more on equal footing. It really is fantastic. So
again, this drops April 29th, which is a day after this episode of The Ready Room will actually be available to everyone to listen to. So if you haven't pre-ordered, go ahead and grab it. The price usually drops on the day of release on Amazon and maybe like the first week. And I'm sure you can also get deals in the States, you know, if you go to Best Buy or those types of stores as well. I don't know if they're carrying Enterprise box sets in those stores or not. I'm sure they have the TNG ones. But the current price on Amazon today is $74.96. The retail is $129.99. $74.96 is the same price as when I pre-ordered on March 20th. So that hasn't changed, or it's come back down. Keep your eyes open, though. If you're an Enterprise fan, it's priceless. If you're a Star Trek fan who wants to give Enterprise a chance finally, I highly recommend these Blu-ray sets. I really think you'll love this show. One more thing in news today, Matthew, and this actually sort of relates to that story. There are a lot of fan film projects or independent productions out, so much so that I created a whole show about it, Continuing Mission, which I mentioned when we were talking about STO and having Tim Russ on to talk about Renegades. There's Star Trek Continues, there's Renegades, there's Star Trek Axanar, there's, of course, New Voyages Phase 2, which has been around for a long time, independent films like Of Gods and Men as well. There's one out now called Star Trek Horizon, and it's actually set in the Enterprise time period, and it follows up the series. It centers around the NX-04 Discovery, and it takes place during the Romulan War. And it looks amazing. And you've seen the clips now, you know, preparing for the show. What did you think about this?
Chris, I thought this was actually really cool. The fact that somebody's going into the Enterprise era, it's an era that is just so ready to be mined, the Romulan War, and leave it to Star Trek fans to take this on. It should be done, I think, God, if they would just have made a film series about this, it could have just been brilliant. It just well done. And so I'm so glad to see that the fans doing this, and the teaser that they had looked beautiful. The Discovery itself is just really well rendered.
Yeah.
And so I am quite excited to see what this looks like. They are doing great in their Kickstarter too. I mean, they blew right past their initial goal of $10,000, and their stretch goals are from 15 to 25,000. And so it runs through May 20th, and so if you take a look at this and just think, man, these guys deserve you know, 10-20 bucks, whatever. I think it's totally worth it. They really do, and have, I think, created something very cool. And
they really have.
It's great to see fans creating. I mean, Chris, when Enterprise was like in its second season and fans were kind of abandoning the show, can you imagine having, you know, a group of fans go out and create this kind of visual representation of that universe?
No.
This way at all? I mean, it's fantastic.
It's great. Yeah, they're at 13,500 right now as we record, with 189 backers, and they just started the campaign on April 19th. So it's barely been a week. They just blew right past that, which is wonderful to see. And the story behind it, in a nutshell, the Horizon story, is the Coalition of Planets, a young alliance of worlds led by Earth, is at war with the Romulan Empire. Desperate for a chance to gain the upper hand in the war, the Coalition forms an alliance with Tamar, a Romulan deserter, in the hopes that she can provide valuable intelligence on her former masters. Now, you may hear that and you may be thinking, oh my God, sacrilege, you're already violating canon. We can't see the Romulans. No one's seen the Romulans. We get the Balance of Terror. They've thought about this. There's a way they're working it out where it doesn't violate canon. In fact, I actually, just yesterday, I recorded a show for Continuing Mission with Tommy Kraft, who is the writer and the director and the producer of this story, and Mark Bowers, who's playing the first officer. And Tommy Kraft, he is an extraordinarily talented individual. And when you go and you watch the trailer of what they're doing, listen to the music they've put together, look at the stills, watch the behind-the-scenes videos that they've already produced, you're going to be very impressed. Next Saturday, on Continuing Mission, you'll be able to hear Tommy and Mark and me talk about this. And when you find out how they're putting this together, you're going to be blown away, I think, because it's amazing what they're doing with almost no money. The $10,000 Kickstarter is nothing. I think you'll be really, really impressed. So I really encourage everyone to go check this out and support what they're doing. It's really beautiful. So we'll put a link in the show notes to their website and to their Kickstarter campaign as well, and check that out. Well, that's all we have in news, Matthew. Before we jump into the feature, where we're going to be joined by Michael Fisher and a new panelist, Von Glitschka, to talk about the DS9 episode, The Sound of Her Voice, we'd like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. They are the best source for audiobooks you'll find anywhere. Over 150,000 titles are waiting for you right now. They put hundreds of new titles on the site every week. They have a great internal studio for recording science fiction. Some of the greatest science fiction novels that have never been turned into audiobooks before are being done by Audible, with some of the best narrators that you'll hear. And I love the fact that they're putting the money into bringing the great science fiction classics to us, and making sure that those get the proper treatment that they deserve. They do have new releases and current bestsellers on there as well. And, you know, these books, these days the publishers know I need to put stuff out as audio. But there's so much great literature out there yet to come to audio. Now, one thing we like to do every week is to recommend a book to you, because as a Trek FM listener, you can try Audible for a month and you can choose any audiobook that you want absolutely free. And they have lots of Star Trek books on there. And the book that I'd like to recommend today is Ashes of Eden by William Shatner. Matthew, I know you've read Ashes of Eden. You really like the Shatnerverse, and of course, you and I co-host Literary Treks together. You're our resident book expert here on the network. Why should people go and check out Ashes of Eden?
You know, I think that the Shatnerverse books are really well done for the most part. And one of the best parts about it is that if you're desiring to read a Star Trek book or listen to one on Audible, and you're kind of worried about, you know, not knowing about the continuity of a lot of these books, especially in the 24th century these days, the Shatnerverse is a great place to start because it doesn't have anything to do with any of their other books. It's set in its own universe. And it gives you a great opportunity to just explore the characters that you really loved a lot. And in this one, Ashes of Eden, we really get to explore Kirk after the events of the Undiscovered Country and really struggling with being retired and finding a way to make a difference again. And it's a fun story. It's lots of adventure, and it's well worth your time listening to.
And it's narrated by William Shatner as well.
Exactly. So. And what could be better?
Yeah, you can't get much better than anything narrated by William Shatner. So go check it out. Like I said, as a Trek FM listener, we do have a special offer for you, which is a free audiobook of your choice. The way you get that is to go to audibletrial.com/TrekFM and sign up. Choose Ashes of Eden, or you can choose any book that you want and get that for free. And if at the end of the trial you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep that audiobook. That's yours. But if you love podcasts, I know you're going to love audiobooks. So give it a try today. By trying Audible, you'll be supporting us. You'll be helping us keep the Ready Room coming to you every week, as well as all of our other shows. And again, audibletrial.com/TrekFM. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. War changes people, and that's no different whether you're in the 21st century or the 24th. Just before DS9 kicked into high gear for its final season, our crew took a quiet moment to reflect in The Sound of Her Voice, the penultimate episode of Season 6. And today we're going to talk about this unique story, and to help us do that, we're joined by a new panelist here on The Ready Room. First time on the show, it is Von Glitschka. Hello, Von. Welcome.
Thank you.
Great to have you with us. First time here in the Ready Room.
Yes, I'm excited about it.
And you are a Niner, aren't you?
Oh, definitely. Most definitely. Yes.
Excellent. And also joining us is a familiar voice to many of you. Today we're bringing you the dulcet tones of Mr. Michael Fisher.
Yes. Chris, I'm coming on the air and I'm so bummed out by this episode that I have just had to spend the last hour in Paris in 1928 in the Hollow Suite. So forgive my, my 1920s attire and,
all right.
You know, yeah,
well,
dance.
I have to say the way Major Kira looked walking into that Hollow Suite, I wouldn't be too bummed out about being there.
You know, you make a good point. The major flapper was in evidence, and it was fine.
All right. Well, let's get into this. And before we get into the discussion, a quick recap of the episode for those who haven't seen it in a long time or maybe don't remember what happened here exactly. It's sort of a unique bottle show for the most part, where they are coming back from a mission on the Defiant. They receive a distress call from a Starfleet captain who's very far away, 6 days away at High Warp. Sisko decides to go try to rescue her. She's on an L-class planet where her ship, the USS Olympia, has crashed. And the whole episode is pretty much our crew talking to her over a subspace channel to keep her company, because she's most likely going to die before they can get to her. And it really sets up a great opportunity for our crew to reflect upon themselves. And that's pretty much what the episode is. Now, there is a B-plot where Odo, with the urging of Quark for his own purposes, of course, is going to celebrate the one-month anniversary of his first date with Kira. And also, there's a little bit of Jake in there as well, as we follow his blossoming writing career as he writes a crime novel. And in the end, they get to the planet. They do find out that Captain Kuzak is dead. There's a little bit of a twist there at the end, which we'll talk about as well. And that's the episode. So, Matthew, you chose the episode. I think you're the first person who suggested this episode this week. So why don't we talk about the voice in the darkness first and the basic concept of this episode?
Well, you know, Chris, I like the idea behind the episode. You know, the war had been going on for a while, and it had been getting darker and darker. I mean, season six had started off with a huge six-part arc of retaking Deep Space Nine. The war had really dominated the season, and we knew the last season was coming up. And so this episode, like you said, it was just a quiet way of giving these characters a way to talk about what was going on, but not in like that kind of TNG way, which Miles actually makes fun of, having the ship's counselor.
Yeah, they
on,
did.
On,
yeah,
on, make fun of the counselor. Exactly. Yeah. Which I feel like it's just Ron Moore speaking at that point. But just a fantastic ability to let these characters just kind of breathe for a moment. As we know now, I mean, it's going to hit the fan next episode. It's going to get really bad for them. I mean, if they thought it was bad now, it's going to be even worse then. And giving these characters this push then to reconnect and find their friendships again is going to be really important as they go into that next episode. And then, of course, the beginning of season seven. So I feel like the writers really knew what they were doing. But also, it's just a fantastic character episode, I think, giving us an opportunity to really dive into how war changes people, the isolation it brings, the mm-hmm. the frustration it brings, the hardness of trying to relate to those who aren't necessarily a part of the war the way you are. You know, you're in the military, you have civilians who really aren't in the same way. So just all these different issues, Deep Space Nine, as it always does, I think, just tackled them head on. Now, whether it all plays out perfectly in the end, that's something we'll probably talk about. But I think the setup and most of the execution in the episode is fantastic. And it's just one of those episodes that's a little bit quieter with a funny, you know, we do get a great B-side story. Who would have known? I mean, Jake would give us a great B-side story. Yeah.
Well,
all in all.
Is it Jake?
Yeah, all in all. Well, it's Jake and Quark together. And actually, those two together are actually pretty funny, I thought. So, you know, all in all, I just really do enjoy this episode. I it's one I can honestly pull out and watch anytime, because I just really enjoy where it takes me with these characters. And, you know, it's not a lot of explosions or anything, but there's some funny, there's some sad. It's a really good episode. So I just thought it would be a great time talking with Michael and Vaughn about, especially since, too, Michael, I know you like the character-driven episodes as well. So
more specifically, even than that, I love episodes like this where you get a wonderful cocktail, like you say, of a strong B story, but an A story that's really compelling and that has a cool twist in it, which, of course, we'll talk about. But I do have a PSA, though. When Chris sent me the email, and the episode discussion was happening, we were choosing what episode to do, and I heard that Sound of Her Voice was a possibility, I kind of exploded with joy. I figured you guys would have done this one already, and I was like, no, thank you. And it's a lot like another DS9 episode, Children of Time.
But yes.
Yeah.
This PSA, however, is directed at anyone who's introducing someone to Star Trek for the first time, because as I said in our Children of Time podcast, I used that episode to introduce Star Trek as a whole to my then girlfriend. And then I followed, which was a great move. It was awesome. But then I followed it up with Children of Time, perhaps trying to drive the point home that Star Trek is not all just funny rubber foreheads and explosions in space, but explored some deeper themes at times. And by the end of this episode, while she did enjoy it, she said to me, "You need to show me something happy that happens on this show." I'm like, good call. So don't overdo it on the malaise.
You know, I will say Children of Time is a great analogy here. They are quite similar, aren't they? But Children of Time is more in the vein of a Star Trek episode that you might find in one of the other series. It has more of the Star Trek element to it, I think. And it's much more about the character interactions with one another, especially with Kira and Odo, whereas this is much more like this episode could be on another show, even not even Star Trek, and it's more about the internal perspective of each person, I think, and how things are affecting them. Vaughn, what are your thoughts on this episode?
I'd say it's one of my favorite ones that kind of features Quark. He's probably, out of all the characters, I enjoy him the most. I don't know if it's because of... there's a nefarious side of myself, but yet I consider myself caring about friends, but I also like kind of being a little devious at times, and so I resonate with that. But this episode was just fun because he kind of exposed a lot of the characters were... Other people exposed other characters in terms of truths about them that you didn't know otherwise. And I think that's what I enjoyed the most, especially just hearing Quark confess his true feelings to somebody else and he thinks it's in private when actually Odo is, you know, eavesdropping on him. So.
And I also like there that you see that side of Odo as well when we find out that he was there the whole time and he heard it. And that Odo sort of took that to heart too, and I think did something unexpected in realizing that Quark actually cared about him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an episode in which a lot of unexpected things happen, and you know within the first 30 seconds, I think, that it's going to be an episode like that because the way the episode kicks off, if you're not watching the series, rewatching the series from front to back, if you're just coming upon the episode in a late night rerun, things are different. Sisko's being cold to Cassidy. Bashir's not full of jokes. Nobody's really getting along with each other. And the music underscoring the whole thing is it has more personality than even DS9 music usually does. And so it's a very glum kickoff to the episode. And you're like, there may not be a paradigm shift in this episode, but there's going to be, you know, this ain't going to be a trip to the ice cream store and, you know, and nobody's going to be buying a unicorn sticker today. This is going to be kind of a deep time, you know?
Man, I really miss the unicorn store, though. That's my favorite shop on the promenade.
You want to make sure your ice cream shop has unicorn stickers.
I know. It's
Bajoran children
when
are never
I don't
gonna
get my unicorn sticker, I'm so mad.
It's no use buying Jumja in that mind state.
But then they get busted because Quark is overseeing it all, and they find out that the unicorn is actually just a goat with its horns pressed together.
So counterfeit space unicorn stickers.
It's run by the Space Ringling Brothers Circus, yes.
Oh, gosh. Oh, man.
Do you guys remember the big unicorn promotion in the 80s? Anyway, maybe it was early, mid-80s, the Ringling Brothers Circus with the unicorn. I remember it coming to town. I went to that circus.
No. Yeah,
it was a goat. With
I think
horn.
It was a little before my time.
I was actually in the Ringling Brothers Circus once when I was a kid.
Oh,
I got
wow.
to ride really? All the way around, all through the rings. My father had some connection with the event, and they got me in. And there were like I don't know how many of us there were. I remember.
This
anymore,
explains
like 20
a
children,
lot,
maybe. And we got to be, they had like a part of the circus where these, like the aliens came and abducted some children from the audience and brought them down and
they
put them
in.
And
the circus?
Yeah.
Really? That's awesome.
Yeah. And I get to ride around.
I've been missing a great time.
Sounds like a Star Trek circus that you went to.
Seriously, right. Are you sure this wasn't just a convention, Chris? Like, you know, sometimes they can be a circus, but.
All right. Anyway, well, so that's the setup of the episode. Let's get into the kind of the meat of it here, the calm before the storm, that, you know, the crew has already been through so much during the Dominion War. And by making contact with this captain, Lisa Kuzak, the writers were able to give the crew a sounding board, basically. And the way they do it is very effective, where they actually isolate the crew members. So we don't have like a group conversation with her. It's, they're like taking shifts. And Miles doesn't even want to give up his time to Jules, right? He's like, no, it's already 1800. What do you mean? No, I don't want to stop talking now. Right. And yeah. It's very effective for letting them talk about their problems and kind of get things off their chests. And also to convey to us how the war is impacting each person and also impacting them in a different way. So how do we feel about this part of the story, which would be the A plot here, how it fits into the overall war arc and what it tells us about our crew members as well?
I think it just gives us a really, you know, strangely deep insight for Star Trek. I mean, coming off again, The Next Generation, you would never have seen this. A character kind of dive into their own psyche and talk about what's really going on. I mean, one, nobody had a relationship anybody cared about. Nobody wanted to see Worf and Troy open up about their, you know, whatever was going on there. And so the
you don't
fact
want to
that,
find out exactly why Troy likes Worf so much. Right?
I don't care. But
ridges.
Oh, he does a great barrel roll in certain places. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
that might be the best barrel roll reference ever on the Ready Room.
But I think what it was great is, I mean, I really gravitated towards when Miles was talking to her and he's laying there in the bunk and he's sharing about this sense of isolation that war is creating, even with his closest friends. And this idea that I don't want to talk to somebody, especially if they maybe have just gotten transferred here, because the likelihood that they may die soon is big. I mean, this war has taken its toll in lives, and it's also taking its toll in life and how I live it. And, it says a lot for the way I think real war affects people and, coming home and the frustration of trying to fit back in after of all you've seen when you don't really know how to, you know, talk to people or help them understand whatever it is that you've been through. And it's got to be frustrating when you do feel like the only person you could talk to is some sort of licensed therapist is, you know, we mm-hmm. made fun of the fact that Miles was talking about the ship's counselor and all. And, the idea of, you know, she just asked him point blank, why aren't you talking to your friends about this? He's like, but it's just not really the thing you talk about in polite conversation, you know, but the idea of that real friendship dives deep, you know? And I think that even just resonates for all of us in this, you know, completely consumer driven, social media driven culture where we utterly feel alone, even though we may be talking to hundreds of people at a time. But are we talking about anything deep? Are we talking about anything real? You know, and do we have those people who are going to challenge us and love us and like be there for us through it all? You know, that's really what it's about. And I love that this episode really drives at the heart of that. Because that's a problem in humanity from the beginning, you know? So it's not as like it's anything new, but it's just a great Star Trek reminder that it's about people. It's about connecting. It's about family. And Deep Space Nine, above a lot of the other shows in Star Trek, really creates a family that ends up knowing each other really well. Because we know them really well. And that was unique for Star Trek, at least since I feel like the original series where we felt like we knew Bones and Kirk and Spock really well. But I actually think we know the characters on Deep Space Nine better if you were to like what we actually know about them. So, yeah. And their relationships, honestly, you know, like Miles and Julian and all of that, those kind of relationships we get on the show. So, this is a deep thinker of an episode, and when you watch it, it drives that point home really well, and it you know, leaves me thinking. And that's great Star Trek. That's just great drama.
It is. And you get to know some of the more specific portions of particularly O'Brien's psyche in that conversation. I think that's one of the more telling conversations we see in the whole show.
O'Brien is probably the best part of the episode in terms of the conversations. And again, so much of that comes down, I always say this when we talk about O'Brien, to Cole Meany. It's just guy doesn't even act. It's just like it's so natural that it's him.
That's brilliant. Yeah, yeah. And even from minor stuff to where Cassidy's kind of feeling a little bit burned by Sisko, mm-hmm. not really liking her around. So she comes down to engineering and asks O'Brien, like, do I make you uncomfortable, a civilian hanging out on the warship? And O'Brien's like, nah, don't bother me. I've got plenty of civilians before. It's that.
Wait a minute, Michael. Who did you say that was? Who are you talking about here?
Cassidy Yates. I didn't rub the bridge of my nose in a giant expression of stress. Cassidy Yates. But that's part of that naturalism you were talking about with Cole Meany, yes, but also in the lines that are written for O'Brien, you know, we've gotten to know him so well, but none of this is a surprise, but it's more in the category of shading, where he's talking about agreeing with Lisa about the notion of a ship's counselor. You know, even the tones that Cole Meany is using work together with the text. And he's like, yeah, no, me too. I always have thought that. It seems like this day and age, you know, you the only people you're allowed to talk to solve your problems, or they have to have a diploma. And it's that kind of – it's a masterful portrayal of the working class hero kind of thing that O'Brien is without making me feel – you know, guilty and without coming across as too heavy-handed. He's just, you know, O'Brien is just the everyman who's just trying to get by. And mm-hmm. the world's so complicated. I'm just trying to, you know, live my life. But it's hard. I think he's so relatable in this episode, even above and beyond where the way like, that he usually is elsewhere.
He's like Jango Fett. He's just a simple man trying to make his way in the universe.
Just trying to get by, you know, capture a dude every now and then. It's fine.
Yeah.
When I was kind of reviewing, I had just watched this episode about a month prior to this. And so I watched it again a couple times this last week. And it did make me think a lot about friendships. And I think that term friendship is a friend is thrown around a lot nowadays. And it's kind of cheapened it, you know, Facebook. You know, I guess I have 3,500 friends. You know, I call it acquaintance book. and it made me think about my friends, the people I consider my closest friends. And I'll be honest with you, after I watched it the first time this week, I texted my friend right afterwards and just said, how you doing? You know, so it made me kind of want to do the same thing these other characters were talking about. And it also made me realize that, you know, you look back in life and you think about the friends you've had at different points in life, and you go from one chapter to the next almost, and friends change, people change, and you lose contact with people. And I think of some of the people I used to consider pretty close friends, and you've kind of drifted apart. And we recently moved well, not recently, it was about 6 years ago, but when we did that, you would think we had moved to Africa, and certain friends of ours just stopped contacting us. And it was weird. I was going, I still think it's kind of strange. So I enjoy how all the characters of Deep Space Nine specifically, you actually see their lives change, and they go through these different chapters of their lives, and the dynamic changes, and you don't see that depth of relationship on like the Next Generation, for example. So that's what I enjoy the most about this whole show.
That's a good point, because I'm guilty of that too, where if you're not actively in my life and what's going on, because my life is so insane with my family and my children and the ages they are and work and everything, it's really easy to lose contact with someone, even if they're nearby. And then like you, Vine, I moved about, it's been actually almost 8 years ago now, I think. And like for the first year or so, you kind of keep in touch with those people, and then it tapers off. And now you still talk to them like twice a year, maybe. But you do lose track of those relationships.
I think another really cool thing about this episode is I think it's pivotal, because if you don't have this episode, I don't think that the next episode, the end, or what happens then in season 7 at the beginning makes as much sense. Because this episode kind of helps set the stage that these characters are in a already kind of in a dark place. And then what happens in that last episode, spoiler alert, is that, you know, Jenzia is killed, and it throws Sisko for a loop. I mean, he's done. Mm-hmm. He's gone. He's got nothing left. And you can tell with this episode that he was already in that place.
Oh, totally. Yeah. When they get the distress call and Sisko's like, how far away is it? Mm-hmm. Is there anyone else who can take care of this? Okay. We're going to be the heroes. Fine. You're right. You're right, Matthew. I mean, you can tell that he's been worn on and just ridden so hard. And I think that the Dax death the snapping point that inspires would not make as much sense without this episode. I'm saying that even though you already said it, because I was going to disagree with you until I thought about it. And now you're absolutely right. It's wild how crucial this episode is to the next one and to the arc of the end of 6 as a whole.
It's my scintillating intellect in the beard. It always brings people around.
That's what it is. Yeah. I need to look away so that I can more dispassionately evaluate your arguments.
Oh, it's a good thing I didn't sing for him, Chris. He'd be gone.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Oh, goodness. Well, Chris, I just thought it was interesting. And we get to, in this episode, the B side of the plot, you know, the Kira and Odo's monthiversary. And I just thought it was so funny of all the people to put together on the station to be bosom buddies for an episode. Jake and Quirk. Like, you know, like, but I just love that they're the duo for this episode, and the way that they play off of each other. I thought that it was really funny.
What I think is interesting about that is that, so Jake wants to be a writer, and of course for your writing to be effective, and he's writing a crime novel, for your writing to be effective, it has to be believable to the real world for people. And Jake has to learn. Like, he has this preconceived notion of what the criminal is, right? And Quark sort of shows him the reality of it. You know, Quark says, you criminals never see themselves as nefarious. And the pairing there, I think, is interesting to follow. I mean, they never really developed the Jake storyline as him being a writer sufficiently through the show. But it is yet another realistic take on it, whereas, like, Jake's going to school and Quark's the teacher, and Quark's gonna show him, like, this is how life really works. This isn't the Starfleet Federation, everybody's happy, nice to each other crap. This is real. And if you're going to write a novel about it and you want people to actually enjoy the novel, then you need to know how things work.
Yeah.
It reminds me a little bit of Honor Among Thieves too, where O'Brien spends time in the Orion Syndicate and he begins to kind of like feel for these guys. And in the same way, like, I think that this just gives a new understanding for Jake about Quark and Ferengi and a new sense of respect for him, almost, that, you know, Quark isn't just about profit. I mean, when he has that whole heart-to-heart about how, you know, he helped Odo actually find the love of his life, like, he cares enough. It's not just profit, you know.
At this point, he's not all about profit. Now, at the beginning of the series, maybe
right,
so. I think
exactly,
it also
yeah.
shows how much Quark has grown over
exactly.
the course of 6 seasons.
Yeah, for sure. So I think that's a really neat thing to have them do with a character that, and really, I think, drives home that point, how much Quark has changed in 6 seasons. Like, he is definitely not that same character. And it's a really neat way to do that. But it also, it the same way, it gives Jake that understanding of that he might not have had before. So I think that's a neat thing that they do on this show. They're not afraid to take our preconceived notions of somebody and allow them to be shattered slowly over time.
I agree. I thought you were going to say turn them on their lobe.
No. I'm sorry. I don't turn a phrase quite as well as you do, Chris.
I agree that it was a smart move, and I'm really glad that they used Jake to do it, because essentially what you're doing is finding somebody who can externalize Quark's inner monologue for the B story. Mm. And Jake Sisko is the best character to use for that, because, man, he's just not a very fun character to watch, I think. I mean, for me, certainly, and maybe for one or two more people out there. So one of the nice things was that his dialogue was nicely honed for this episode. He was kind of just the foil for Quark. And also, some of the things that Quark was expressing, I was completely 100% behind. And the showrunners did a really good job of leveraging DS9's kind of serial format here, because when Quark is in the cargo bay saying he and Kira never would have gotten together, I was the guy who had to live, beneath him or above him? I think it's beneath him. And hear him tearing his apartment apart because he's lovesick. I went up there to talk to him. I did all this stuff, and he can't let me get away with one thing. F this guy. Forget it. I'm leaving. And there was even more written that didn't get filmed, or if it got filmed, it got cut, about Quark kind of talking about his cursed life and how Odo just should let him have one. And by the end of his monologue, and he and Jake walk out of the cargo bay with their shoulders slumped and they're real sad, I'm like, yeah, Odo, you better dematerialize out of those barrels and be like, I got to think about this, because he's right. And it's freaking true, man. And I'm really glad that Odo ended up, giving him a little break. I thought that was nice.
Quark's lamentations about, him always getting nailed for minor infractions and other things that Odo keeps pinning him down on, but then on the other hand, he's not being recognized for the small good things that have benefited other people. And then he culminates all of that by quoting the rule of acquisition that he did. And I'm not sure if that is the first time that one was declared in this episode, the no good deed goes unpunished. But I thought that was a quote a friend of mine locally coined years ago, but I think he ripped it off of Deep Space Nine.
Your friend claimed to have invented the phrase "no good deed goes unpunished."
Yeah,
I think that one's been around for a while.
Yeah, I think it has.
That's great.
I think the other part of the story, which is great, is to watch Odo not realize, I don't think at the beginning, that he's being played by Quark. I don't think he totally gets that he's being played. He's like, 1 month anniversary, whatever. And then he's like, oh wait, I've never been in a human, a humanoid relationship before like this. Crap. What if I'm doing this all wrong? He really is. The moment she comes in, his whole demeanor just changes on a dime. It's just amazing. So I do love that Quark is using it, but, in some ways, it's still kind of teaching him what it means to be in a humanoid relationship. And that's what we do. You're with somebody, you celebrate together that you're together for a month, and then you make it 6 months, and then you make it a year. And those things, they mean something to us, the passage of time, which I guess, too, for Odo, he doesn't really understand, because he's pretty much eternal. As long as he's not killed. And so that him kind of wrestling with what this all means is kind of an interesting thing. I would have loved to have seen just a little bit more of that in the show, because, the idea that Odo and Kira might be together for a really long time, it's kind of like Lord of the Rings, where, an elf and a human are going to be together. The human's going to die. The elf's going to live for a really, really, really long time, So. Well,
I think what's interesting here with this B story is that, unlike a lot of B stories in Star Trek, you could do an entire episode on this and make it the A story and then explore more of that like you're talking about.
Yeah, and in less capable hands, I think we would have seen either Odo have the what's that expression? Have the leather pulled over his eyes or have the bag put over his head? Or
I don't know. Vaughn, did your friend coin a phrase related to that?
Yeah, Vaughn, can you shed some light on that? No, to have the wool pulled over, that's what it is. So, you know, I think I was fearing that in my first view of this episode. Oh, man, is Odo going to get tricked by Quark? Because that's just not very plausible. The opposite extreme, like, you know, Odo just nabs him for it at the end of the episode and it's like, waka waka, gotcha again. No, once again, we go to the deeper place with DS9, the more satisfying place where Odo's he knows the whole time that Quark is trying to play him, but he doesn't let him get away with it. Oh, wait, yes, he does, because it's a nice surprise.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the more satisfying B stories I think I've seen.
Quark
talk about it.
Leaves it thinking that he has finally
yes.
tricked Odo.
Right.
Well, yeah, and it's that whole idea where he thinks he actually got away with it at the end makes me think. I mean, earlier you heard him say that he always catches me. I can never get away with it. And then he believes he did by the end, which makes me think, I don't think he believed he would ever get away with it if he couldn't switch that day. But I don't know. It's like, that's why I said when you guys were mentioning you're going to talk about this episode, I kind of see a duality there where even though Quark wants to be your classic Ferengi and benefit from manipulating a system and making profit. On the other hand, he's been influenced by his friends who are humans and he has compassion for his friends. And so even though some people might think he's manipulating it, I almost think it's his way of doing both roles right. And it works mm-hmm. together. And I think that's why at the end he believes he actually got away with it.
Yeah, that's interesting, Vaughn, that you bring up the change in time in Quark, because I think, yeah, if you look at Emissary and you see him there and he's really he's not terribly likable. He's much more nefarious than anything. And then
at one moment you thought he was going to pull out his laser whip, right?
Totally. Because you know he just hangs out with one of those wind socks in his pocket. Yeah. But and to see him kind of have softened over the years is interesting. And from a personal perspective, I see that evidenced in my own life. I moved to Boston 6 years ago from an area that was significantly different in thinking. And it's like I think if 6 years ago me met present day me, I think a lot of our positions on some pretty important issues will have meandered somewhat purely as a result of being in a new environment. And so it's very easy to see that happening to Quark. It's very easy to believe. It's very plausible to me with this added perspective, not having rewatched this episode in years.
When it really brings home that whole idea when Quark talks about the Federation and how they're like root beer and they're bubbly and they're sweet and they're insidious okay. and they just get under your skin, you know, and before you know it, you're like them. Yeah. And I think that the reality of that is that there is something about people that are loving and good and kind that draws us to them, you know, in real life. You know, we are drawn to those kind of people because we know instinctively that's not really how most people are. Most people are selfish and mean and, you know, just they're out for themselves. But when somebody is genuinely kind and real, you're drawn to that person. You know, you want to know them more because that's not what we get usually on a daily basis all the time with most people we run into. Most people are just kind of indifferent to most others.
Come to Boston, brother. We're all nice up here. come be my neighbor.
Man,
every time, like
the idea of being Michael Fisher's neighbor is just awesome.
Just we got sound booths in every apartment. It's
apparently
awesome. You should come up here and yeah, because every time Matthew gets philosophical, I'm like, man, Matthew, like I want to meet some of the people that lead to these like digressions because they seem nasty and mean and I don't want to like God, let's just visit, man.
I think it's this, you know, having worked a lot of like customer service and retail in the world, that kind of stuff, you learn really what the heart of people is because when people think that you are expendable, like you don't really matter, try food service or anything like that. Ooh, I mean, you know what the heart of people is like when you work in those, and it's not good, you know?
I was retail for about 8 years. I got you. I understand.
So I think that's probably where it comes from, Michael. I know lots of great people here in Texas. I have lots of great friends. And so, I love though that you really do get this thing of again, watching work from the beginning of the series morph into this completely different guy. And I mean, he's not going to be Rom by the end of the series where he's like changing Ferenginar forever, but he is somebody who has been softened in the way that he is not willing to just destroy somebody anymore for his own gain. Like he thinks much more about others, first, and more than he'd like to admit. And more than he would admit to anyone, except for, like, this is great, because in this episode, he really pours his heart out to Jake, saying, I really care about this Odo guy. And yeah, we kind of are frenemies, but, you know, I just want this one thing. Can he just give me this one, you know?
It was great to see it turn out that way, too. Just that when the episode opened, I thought, this is great. We're at the end of season 6. And we've got the classic DS9 opening, Quark and Odo in the bar. Because you remember early on in DS9, it's like every episode opens that way. And this little conversation between them. And I loved seeing that here right near the end before the big push. And then I'm finally getting away with one and letting him do it.
The best part of that scene right at the beginning is right at the end where he spins Morn around and he's just sitting there spinning. I love that.
Yes.
Yeah, that was fantastic. And he says, this isn't going to cause vertigo for anyone. Yeah. He spins him around.
Oh, man.
I wanted to see an episode of Cheers where, you know, Sam or Woody went over and spun Norm around like that, though. Would have been great. Well, let's talk about the twist of time at the end. And this is something where I had not watched this episode in quite a long time. And I had forgotten about the twist. And then, I mean, I remembered, of course, that Captain Cusack dies at the end. I remember all of that. But I had forgotten about the twist that was being caused by the barrier around the planet. I actually think the twist was very, very clever, because what it allowed them to do was, like, if you think about it scientifically, at first you think, like, it's okay, well, here's one of these Star Trek technobabble things where, because of the barrier, her transmission was being shifted through time, and then that you kind of go, okay, well, maybe. But then our signal back to her was being shifted in time in exactly the same way, going in the other direction so that we could have two-way communication. And you're thinking, I don't think so.
Well, O'Brien had to work real hard to get that working, Chris. You know, he had to crawl under at least one countertop with a space screwdriver. So, like,
he did.
You know, it's not, you know, it wasn't easy.
Apparently, he borrowed a sonic screwdriver finally and was able to fix that whole time issue. That's why it was working. You know, he's like, you know, yeah.
It's all you need, really.
Exactly.
Can I also say something about the conversation when he's working on that, when he's trying to get the signal cleared up so they can actually communicate with Lisa Cusack here? She's talking in the background the whole time while the other characters are talking to each other as well. If you listen very closely to what she's saying when Bashir comes in and he says, do you have to have that going all the time? And he says, well, she's talking. I think that's nice to listen. And he says, well, she doesn't even know that you're listening to her. Can't you turn that off? If you listen closely to what she's saying right there, she says, this stuff in the survival kit is barely edible. Who approves the recipes for these things anyway? Someone who never had to eat them. That's for sure. I thought it was hilarious that she's saying this and Miles is listening to it, because we all know that Miles loves field rations.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, he just
that's funny.
Fun.
That's a good.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's complaining about those same rations, and he's listening to her. happily because he thinks it's the right thing to do because she's trapped and she's dying on this planet somewhere. And he wants to at least respect her enough that he's going to keep that signal playing audibly, even though he doesn't have to.
What I always wondered with this episode, like when they pick up her signal and they hear her voice and as information starts coming out, as they get closer, there's a lot of times where Starfleet has dealt with time rifts or that kind of storyline, that kind of plot device. But doesn't Starfleet have some kind of protocol where they plug that ship name into our database and pull up like, oh, wait a minute, that ship crashed 3 years ago. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, nobody's plugging anything into a computer to find out about it?
I think, though, they answer that in the episode, that they've been gone for so long. They, on their way back, it doesn't sound like that they had made contact with Starfleet before they go off onto this planet. So that's kind of what I had gotten. I mean, it's iffy, but that's what my, like, headcanon was saying to me, like, they were far enough away on their way home that they still hadn't made contact with Starfleet saying, hey, we're coming back, because they've been gone for 8 years.
I think what Vaughn is saying is that it would be logged into the database that all the ships connect to.
Missing in action.
Well, that's the thing. They wouldn't have known that it crashed because the Olympia had been sent on a survey mission of the Gamma Quadrant and a deep survey mission. So they were going to be out of range probably with Starfleet for a long time. So I think the ship would be either classified as lost, or maybe there would be no reference and it would just simply be that we haven't heard from the ship in a long time. But there would be a reference that, because we find out that Captain Kuzak has been dead for 3 years and 2 months. So certainly if the ship had gone out 3 years ago, there would have been a reference in the database, USS Olympia, dispatched to the Gamma Quadrant on stardate so-and-so. Although that would not necessarily have tipped off the crew that there was some sort of time displacement going on. But what I found interesting is that when you think back, there are all these hints. If you listen to what Lisa talks about, Captain Kuzak, there are all of these things that should have made the crew stop and wonder, why doesn't she know anything about the war? Why doesn't she know about these things that are going on? Like, she clearly has no knowledge of what's going on in the Alpha Quadrant, where she really should have some knowledge if there weren't this time displacement.
And I think we can explain that by, I think communications are probably curtailed a bit. We notice the Defiant's not operating under cloak here, right? So she's got to be a little bit careful about what she's doing. She's pretty far from the front lines, but Worf is still concerned about taking some defenses offline. So we can theorize that the connection – well, he is always concerned about some BS like this. Like, Worf, you have torpedoes, remember? It's cool. We're going to be fine. But, yeah, no, we can theorize that, like, the space Wikipedia link is not necessarily like active all the time. But Vaughn, you tripped off this entire like chain of thoughts in my head. And the only thing that I can think to justify this is that level of fatigue we see at the beginning of the episode is responsible for them missing out on all these guys. It's just like, it's a distress call, whatever. We're just going. I mean, there's nothing we can learn about it. There's nothing we can do. It's a 6-day trip. Let's just talk to her and just get there. It's just,
could be. You know,
I do feel like
everything we need to know.
It's almost like an autopilot, you know, distress call. We go, we fix it, you know, like it is definitely autopilot, you know. The other thing that I thought was really, just interesting about this is that I wish that there had been just a little bit more of her optimism to come through, because she's not in this war. And they are, and kind of a little bit of a reminder of what they're fighting for, you know, that I think that would have been something. If there was anything for me to criticize in the episode, that's an opportunity for the writers to kind of pull that next generation sense of optimism in, and remind these Deep Space Nine characters who have been through this kind of hell and they're still in the, you know, ring seven of it, that there is something better, you know, like she does that a little bit, you know, when she asks Sisko, tell me people still have, you know, get married, fall in love, have families. You know, that's good, but I just feel like it could have been driven home just a little bit more for the character, each of the characters, actually.
Well, that's great, Matthew, because what you just said there about when she talks about tell me people still fall in love and have families and all, where I was going with the whole, forget the technobabble aspect of it, what they did with the writing here that I thought was really interesting is that by having her displaced in time to a time before the war started, it was a way of letting our characters go back to the time before their lives became shattered by this war and reflect on that time. So it was actually a way of taking them backwards in time directly and then letting them talk about how things have changed for them.
Yeah, and I think that that all would have played out just slightly better. And I really, really like this episode, but I really think that the climax was kind of bungled here. We have Bashir kind of heavy-hearted finding her, realizing that all the pieces line up. We've had this wonderful setup on this rainy planet. We don't see a lot of rain in Star Trek, and it's very, very depressing.
Right?
Dismal. Right. Yeah, exactly. But the planet Hellset doesn't look like the planet Hellset. It's actually, you know, it's well imagined, you know, and it's augmented by a nice CGI landscape outside. And, you know, we find her and they're geared up. They've been on this mission for 6 days. They've been talking to her. They know who she is. And then when we find out that she's dead and she's been dead for 3 years, yeah, there's the usual mopey faces and such, but like, we don't even sit there and dwell on it for a second. Chief O'Brien just pipes up with some BS explanation that could have fit elsewhere in the episode. Mm-hmm. And then someone's like, we should bury her. And Sisko's like, no, not here. And I felt like saying like, no, of course not here. I wasn't even suggesting that. Like, we bring her back like you say. Well, so it was just so frustrating for me because even in its initial airing, I'm watching it and I'm like, oh, yeah, this is sad, but why is this is off somehow? And
I took it a bit differently than that because they do downplay it. It is like the whole trip is to get there and then they find her dead and it's like, oh, she's dead. Okay. And we go on. Yeah. But what I took from it is that I didn't need that moment to be played up personally because when they scan her and they find out how long she's been dead, I feel like finding her there dead was so that they could realize that they had been talking in the past. And so it's still all reflective on the characters themselves and what was going on internally for them as they were so introspective about what had been happening to them. And it's almost jarring, I think, for you as the viewer to find out, like, oh my God, they've been talking to someone from 3 years ago this entire time. So I think if they had played up her death more at the end, maybe that part of it wouldn't have been quite as effective for me anyway.
Do you think, I've just thought of this, do you think that they could have contacted her again? I mean, not that
like,
this
let's
would
go
have
back and
any
try
purpose.
This again.
Right. Well, not that this would have served any purpose whatsoever because she's got to be on the planet. And like the only thing you could possibly tell her was like, hey, we're never going to get to you in time. So just take all the triax at once and pass out. No, that's dumb. So there'd be no reason to, but. Gosh, that's
well.
It's,
maybe
it's so sad.
It's an interesting point. I don't think they could have technically. Well, I don't know. See, if they had gone back up in the shuttle to the ship, then from the ship they could have contacted her again, and that would have been 3 years
right.
into the past.
Yeah, that's
so. Then they could have done what you were saying. Yeah, that's interesting.
But
So anyway, couldn't they have sent a rescue notice to Starfleet through the same methodology to get help for her in the past?
Well, I guess the signal only goes to the planet's surface, though.
Right. So it's only to the planet's surface.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
so
and,
maybe,
and
Vaughn, they could have, after they're on the planet's surface, they could have sent a signal out to try to get another Starfleet vessel. But it's going
but then it
into
gets
the
upshifted,
future
though.
That way.
Yeah. Yeah.
They can't
okay.
send it into the past.
They
so.
Did a good job of thinking through it, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't mind the barrier science, by the way. I know it was Star Trek science, but like, okay, it comes in and gets downshifted. It goes out, gets upshifted. I didn't mind it either.
If
the runabout can shrink and then get re-blown up in that other episode just by going the same direction through the thing.
Stop the shrinker.
Excellent. Speaking of not a runabout, but a shuttle here, this is actually the only time that we see the shuttle bay on the Defiant in this episode. And we also don't see shuttlecraft in DS9 very much. And this was a completely different Federation shuttlecraft design.
It was so cool looking.
It's so tiny.
Engines were kind of embedded into the ship rather than being on wings or whatever.
Yeah, I love the Star Trek rule of, like, the shuttlecraft has to look like the mothership. And so we get a new cool shuttle design every time we get a new starship design. It's like, oh, this seems cool.
That's true.
Because the first Defiant shuttle looked like a stupid kid's shoe. I didn't like that at all. It had a weird bend to it and stuff. And this one was sweet looking. I would like one of these shuttles.
I wonder if
it looks like a hot rod in space.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. It really does.
I wonder if it has ablative armor also, just like the mothership.
Probably. That thing's probably the most bad shuttle pod you can get. Pew, pew.
It's probably armed shuttlecraft with quantum torpedoes. The only shuttlecraft in Starfleet that has quantum torpedoes.
That's right. It carries exactly one, because it's so small. It's got like one quantum torpedo and a sled.
A micro quantum torpedo.
Yeah.
I think the best part about this, though, is the end of the episode where they all get together and again, it's Miles and Julian, and they kind of bring it all together about just kind of opening up in front of everyone and about their insecurities. And in front of everyone saying, look, I'm tired of being isolated and I'm tired of being this way. I want to be open with you guys. I want to be family, basically. We've got to live this life together, and we've got to live life. We can't get bogged down in the death and destruction, or we're going to miss what we're fighting for. And I love that is the resounding, message of the episode. When we're rewatching this, we know exactly what's going to happen in the next like 5 episodes. And it's going to be hell for these guys. You know, we thought they were in like level 7 of hell. They're going to hit the bottom ring in the next episode and then the subsequent beginning of the next season. So this is like that kind of beacon of hope shining into that darkness. And it's, it shines through till we get to the other side. But it's about to get really dark.
I find the whole scene at the end very touching and very moving, especially when Miles is speaking. And he clearly has an effect on his crewmates as well. And when you look at Sisko had gone up to Cassidy and told her that, I want to talk to you. I want to explain my behavior, because he's already coming around. And I think it's thanks to what Captain Kuzak told him in their conversations. He's already coming around. But then there's a scene, he doesn't say anything, but they cut to Sisko momentarily while Miles is speaking, and Sisko looks over, turns his eyes over to Cassidy for a second, and you can tell that what Miles is saying is really hitting home for Sisko, and the fact that Cassidy's important to him and that he needs to change the course of their relationship. And it's great because they just do it with the camera, and there's nothing spoken on the part of Sisko or Cassidy there.
Yeah. That's the entire Irish Wake scene is really, really excellent for the kind of subtlety that you guys are talking about. And also there are some really non-subtle elements, like, Worf handing the Irish a huge compliment when after he's, given the description of the ceremony, sounds almost Klingon. And, the fact that O'Brien and Bashir in particular are visibly somewhat drunk, which is cool because it's not like a throwaway joke. It's like, no, this is, we're kind of sad and we're drinking stuff that's not synthahol. And it's a very, very nice cap to the scene. And I think it goes a long way toward making up for what I really think is quite a rushed climax. So yeah, I agree with you, Matthew.
Do you also feel a little bit like with the Irish Wake at the end and when Jadzia explains to Worf what the Irish Wake is? My thought went back to, like, the whole episode is an Irish Wake for the crew, in a sense, as they think about what they've lost over the course of the war so far.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I think that's actually an excellent thought. I mean, to encapsulate the whole episode, you know, this is an Irish wake in space. It's really the entire crux of the episode, and that's really what they're trying to do, to give these characters a time to kind of mourn where they are, where they have been, and maybe give them just a little bit of hope for what's going to happen in the future by the end. In the same way that, you know, hopefully, you go to a good funeral, and if there is such a thing, and it's a celebration of that person's life and what you hope for them to come in the next life, if you believe in that. And I have been to, I've been to some great funerals because of that, where it's not the end. You believe it's also just the beginning, you know, it's just the next great adventure, as Dumbledore would say. And so, I think this is a fantastic way to think about this episode, and it really does its job then for the characters when we get to the end.
Like you've said before, Chris, the actor Colm Meaney he does such a great job that when I might be just reiterating what you've said in the past, but he doesn't seem like he's acting. It's just like a normal person. And so when I reviewed this episode, it kind of like my mind departed from watching the show and thinking about my friends and wanting to contact my friends. And I think that's anytime an actor can kind of draw you in on that level and make you reflect on your own life, I think that's a great thing. And that's why I just love DS9. They do that on a lot of different levels.
They definitely do. Yeah. One last point I wanted to bring up, especially Michael, I wanted to ask you because you're an actor. Captain Kuzak here, Lisa Kuzak, is voiced by Deborah Wilson, who I always knew from Mad TV. And so hearing her do this role was just a drastic departure from what I was accustomed to from Deborah Wilson back when this, you know, episode, when I first saw it. What did you guys think about Deborah Wilson's portrayal of this captain and her situation, considering that she typically does comedy?
For my part, overall, certainly, I think she did a wonderful job with quite a demanding part, especially considering some of these trivia elements of Memory Alpha, where it's like the director didn't let her meet any of the cast while doing the recording. So while you're, if that's true and you're not, your dialogue is being done with someone who's not the other character in the scene, particularly in voiceover, that's supremely challenging. And
there are times where you can tell that that's what's going on.
And then that's exactly what I was just going to say.
Just fine. Yeah.
I've done VO for about 6 years. And so as a result, but you don't even need to do that to to know when someone is being fed a line and then reading about six different variations of reactions. And then the editors are picking one. Yeah. So that's, you know, I think that. So but anyway, that's unavoidable. On the whole, I think she was a very good pick. Now, I don't know, and I would like you guys to tell me if you think that she was terribly captainly, because it did, in fact, seem like she was a ship's counselor rather than a captain at some points.
Yeah, at moments. But there are also moments where I do feel like she is – like I think that I feel the kind of authority that a captain has coming out of her. But definitely there are times where she does seem like a trained counselor. Like even in the bit that we talked about where they're kind of making fun of having a counselor on the ship. But at the end of that, she says, and who's the only person you can talk to? A counselor. So it is like she's bringing you back around to where she wants you to be.
Yeah. It's funny you bring this up because when I watch this episode, I thought, just her voice itself sounded kind of Janeway in the way she phrased things and the way she talked and her kind of authoritative tone. And in that respect, like when she died, there's part of me that wondered if that was just some writer's loose association with what he would have liked to written on the other show.
Well, Ronald D. Moore.
I don't know, but.
Yeah. You know, Ronald D. Moore spent a very short time on Voyager and it really couldn't work with the format of the show. So you may have a point there because he did write the teleplay for this episode.
Yeah. I really think that what she hearkened back to me, you know, the Olympia had been gone for 8 years. And that is what, when would that be in the Next Generation's run? Like if we do the math. Like
season three or something
like
that?
Yeah, around season three, okay. I guess, yeah.
So, you know, from what we know, ship's counselors were relatively a newer thing at the beginning of TNG. So she's in that time period when this is a relatively new thing. And she sounds like she said she dies at the age of 51. So she's lived a lot of her life in Starfleet without having these. So she kind of harkens back to me, kind of that Kirk, Spock, McCoy era where you did rely on your friends, you know, in Starfleet to get you through. You weren't going to the ship's counselor. And that's what this brought out to me. I felt like they were having a conversation with a female version of like a Kirk, you know, who you could go to if you needed advice. And you needed somebody to talk to, and he was going to be open to talking with you, and it was going to be stern when he needed to be stern, but he was also going to be somebody who would listen. And that was really what I felt from her as a captain, that she was just, she was a throwback, you know, she was much more in that vein than say, you know, Picard.
That makes a lot of sense.
And so I felt that more in her captaincy and her command style. And it was great to me because I really like her as a captain because it just showed me that there's different ways to be a captain. You know, we've seen Kirk, we've seen Picard, we've seen Sisko, and at this point now we've seen Janeway. And some ways they're all similar and some ways they're all very different. And she was just had some similarities with all of those people, but also some very clear differences. And like, wouldn't it have been great to be on her ship? I mean, she's a captain that I would have wanted to have been with. I mean, if she's willing to like make funny voices at you, like pretending to be taken over by an alien.
She's not here anymore. I hate her.
Exactly. Like if that's her sense of humor.
You weren't even listening to her anyway.
Can you imagine what like she would have done to you? You know, I mean, I can imagine pranking her first officer because she thinks it's funny.
Totally.
Yeah. You know, that's the kind of ship I expected her to kind of have. So I got all of that from this characterization that this voice actress was giving. It's so fantastic. And I'm really excited that I would love to have somebody write a novel.
I was just thinking non-canon
novel about her and her ship and what happened, you know, where that was maybe the climax of the novel, like, you know, but kind of a little bit more about just because it just seems like she would be such a rich character to get into.
Yeah. The end of the novel is when the Olympia crashes.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Ugh. No, I would want the novel to end way before this because I can't. No, I can't. We already did this. We already got to this point where it's like, oh, you're so cool. Oh, you've been dead a long time. Like, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be there again. No, I want the novel to end 10 years before this happens, you know, when things are happier. I don't know. You guys write it and I'll tell you what I think of it.
We'll get you on Literary Treks to talk about Chris and I's novel. So.
Sounds good.
That's perfect. As the page turns.
All right. Well, let's wrap up with our final thoughts and our ratings. Michael, what are your final thoughts on the episode?
You know me. I don't like to end on a broad, easily digestible note. I like to end on an observation that no one else could possibly care about and has nothing to do with the rest of the episode. But there's a wonderful conversation that happens on the bridge when they're trying to pour on more speed to get to her faster because she's running out of triox because her triox is tainted. A really nice storytelling step, by the way. Cool way of ramping up the stakes a little bit toward the final act. But O'Brien explains that the issue is not that they can't go faster. They can go faster just fine, but the Defiant will tear herself apart. So the conversation then becomes about preventing that. And what this does for us is reminds us – and I God, I always love being reminded of this because it's another example of how DS9 does things differently. The Defiant doesn't work right. It's a powerhouse, yes, but it's a freaking test bed that got pushed into service too early. And it's just one of those things you don't really have to do on any other Starfleet ship. You got to figure out how to keep the ship together so that it stops from shaking itself apart. And that's really cool. It's just another small little reminder of how DS9 is a different world altogether. So I think in addition to those little details, obviously the overarching themes of this episode were just wonderful, fit in perfectly, and I just adored it. So I would award this episode 47 Denevan crystals.
Oh, wow. You can get a lot of gold crust Latin for that rating.
You stole mine.
Apparently 200 bars worth, you know, I'm just saying. Sorry, Matthew.
Apparently so. Well, Matthew, what are your final thoughts on the episode?
Chris, goodness, I honestly don't know what to say after all that we've talked about. We've really taken this episode and I think talked about so much. And I'm with Michael. If you're going to show somebody, I think just the depth of Deep Space Nine and Star Trek in general, this is a great place to go. It dives into characters and yeah, it throws you into their lives and you don't know what's going on, but the amount of just acting that goes on from all of the characters that are on board of Defiant as they're talking to Lisa Kusick is just phenomenal. You know, there's the great scene we didn't even talk about where Avery is playing with the pad on the table because he does not want to be talking, you know, mm-hmm. the same way that we kind of fiddle with things, you know, like mm-hmm. when we don't want to be talking about a subject with somebody and we doing it in person, you know, not even just over the phone. And so I just think all those little touches really sell this. In fact, Michael's doing it right now to me. He's fiddling with his cell phone. He doesn't even want to be paying attention to me. apparently, he looked away and he wasn't mesmerized by the beard and the dulcet tones.
Maintain eye contact if you want to hypnosis to keep working.
But this is just a great episode and. It really is one of my favorites of Deep Space Nine. And I think, you know, if I have to give this episode a rating, I think that I'm going to give this 62.4 Quarks holodeck programs.
Wow. So we're getting 0.4 of one yeah. holodeck program there. All right.
That's right. it's not his – that 0.4, it's not his best work. Okay. So.
All right.
You can see the stripes, like in 40% of the holodeck.
That's, exactly. It's just, yeah.
Well, how about you, Vine? What are your final thoughts?
Well, this is definitely one of my favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine, and mainly because it does make me think about how the topics they're discussing relate to my own life and. Like I said earlier, anytime that happens, I can really resonate with the story. So I enjoyed that a lot about this episode. Any episode that has Quark worked into it is also one of my favorites. So I just really enjoyed the total narrative from beginning to end on this episode. And even though, you know, I have two daughters and you can, when they were younger, I'd buy them a movie and they could watch the same movie over and over and over and over right. again and never get sick of it. And totally. This is one of those type of episodes for me as an adult. I can't say that about every episode, but this one I've watched about four times now and just this past week. And I really, I don't know, I wasn't sick by the time I was done watching it the fourth time. So I think that says a lot. Now this rating thing's a little new to me, so this might be stupid. And I'm sure I'm going to technically mess this up, but I'm going to go for it anyway. I would give this 4 out of 5 bar seats at Quarks.
Excellent.
Nice. That's perfect rating.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
That's an excellent rating. Well, for me, this episode, it's a unique episode in the way that it's so solemn for so much of the time. But it's a fascinating episode that just really, really sucks you in. And it's the kind of episode that you can only do in a late season of a show like this, because you need to have the whole back history, the characters, in order to make it work for the audience. And I also think it's an episode within Star Trek that you could only do on Deep Space Nine, or at least you could only do it and get away with it on Deep Space Nine. I can't see this working effectively in any other series. And it's because of the type of storytelling on Deep Space Nine, but it's also because of where it falls within the story and everything that had happened before it and everything that's going to happen after it. You're able to take this kind of story and nestle it right there and make it really, really effective. So I think it's great. I think it's a great example of the series. And like you said, Michael, you actually used it to introduce people to the series. So I'm going to give this episode 9 injections of Triox compound.
I'm feeling much better now.
Yeah. 20 cc's there for you, Matthew.
Yeah.
Woo! Man, feeling awesome. Woo!
All right. Well, thanks for joining us today, Vaughn and Michael. So before we go, please tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs. Vaughn, where can people find you?
Well, I have an unhealthy habit of hanging out on Twitter most of the time, so you can find me there at Vonster. And my website is just my name, VaughnGlitchka.com.
All right. And that's GlitchKa, Glitchka. Vaughn, you have one of the best Twitter usernames ever in Vonster, I have to say.
Yeah.
Thanks. My friend Matt gave me that nickname.
Oh, yeah? That's because you like to be nefarious from time to time, right, as you said?
Because I irritated him a lot. To be honest.
And Mr. Michael Fisher, where can people find you?
Well, I, too, spend an awful lot of time on Twitter. And in fun fact, Twitter, right before this show, about 3 days before this show, presumably unaware that I was about to podcast with you for the first time, Vaughn, suggested that I follow you. You showed up in my suggested follow list, so I did that. It's weird.
Okay.
It's getting a little googly. It's a very strange move. But anyway, I'm happy to make your acquaintance on Twitter.
I think what happened, Michael, is that recommendation from Twitter passed through the barrier. It was time shifted 3 days and 2 hours.
See, now, but my follow, yes, though, was then shifted as well. So you'll get it in about like 2 years, Vaughn.
Right. Yes, Vaughn. If you look right now and it says that Michael Fisher does not follow you.
Yeah, it's not.
He has. You just don't know yet.
Yeah. Now I'm worried. I have 3 years left.
You know, you just got to last that long and, you know, just to hold out through the rain.
At least, Vaughn, you know that you need to stock up on Triox compound right now. So you've
that's
had
right.
a warning.
Yeah. It's a good call. And just get ready to enjoy some mud. You can find me, if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can find me at Captain Two Phones. It's Captain the number two phones. When I'm not tweeting about Star Trek, though, I do tweet an awful lot about smartphones. So if you want to follow me, you should be advised that you will be seeing a lot of that. And if you have not gotten enough of my stuttering weird voice on this episode, you can find me at the Pocket Now Weekly podcast, where we also talk about smartphones. And now we curse. We took our clean tag off.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Yeah. We grew up. It's weird. And we're hanging around with our, you know, with our parents and drinking beers and just being all grown up and such. So.
Man.
Come give us a listen.
So glad you guys finally put on your big boy pants.
You know, it's weird. I expected a massive backlash, but in fact, everyone was like, finally, hated those beeps, those effing beeps.
Oh, you guys used to actually do it, but you would bleep it out?
Yeah, that's the problem. It added about 45 minutes of editing time, which I just didn't have. So like, F it. We gonna curse now. Yeah, right.
Well, I have to tell you, you know, I mean, if I had to review all those Samsung phones like you do, I'd probably curse too.
Yeah.
just kidding.
Shots fired.
Fighting words. I'm just kidding, Android users. I'm just kidding.
Zap, you're going to get some hate mail.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today, guys.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you.
Chris.
Well, Chris, that was a great discussion on the sound of her voice. I just really love getting a chance to talk about Deep Space Nine episodes, obviously, since I do the Orb with you. But also, great to have Michael Fisher back. I love that guy. He's just fantastic when we have a discussion, I think, and good to be able to break Vaughn in. Hopefully, he enjoyed himself.
I think he did. Yeah, I was glad Vaughn could join us as well. For the first time, you know, Vaughn and I we've talked to each other on Twitter for quite a long time. You know, we're both creative professionals, and it was great to, and he loves DS9, so great to have him on with us. And Michael, you know, I'm chasing Michael all the time, I'm trying to get Michael on the Ready Room more often. I love Michael Fisher. He's a hard guy to catch these days. He's a very, very busy guy, but I'm glad he was with us this time. But Matthew, you know, sound of her voice, great episode choice today. I really enjoyed talking about it with all of you guys, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about on the network this week. So here's a quick look at what else you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Dr. McCoy with Larry Nemechek.
But, you know, when everybody else had their Kirk shirt or their Spock shirt, like the first uniform I had my mom make me was a McCoy uniform, of course.
Earl Grey.
The 7-7 Challenge.
Did you know that Tim Russ was one of the possible choices for Commander Geordi LaForge?
But did you know he was also in Star Trek Generations?
But did you know he was also served with Captain Sulu on board the Excelsior?
I did know that, in fact.
The Orb.
Our Man Bashir Commentary.
I love Avery. Tell me what happens next.
And the look up at an angle. He's not even looking at Bashir, he's looking up at the angle. Tell me what happens next.
The Ready Room.
Spectre of the Gun.
They're so quick to jump to conclusions, like the guy gets shot in front of them and they're like, death is the only thing that's real on this planet. And like, wait a minute, how do you know that? That could just be a total figment of your imagination as well.
To the journey!
Favorite Sun commentary.
Yeah, Janeway is... you better get more coffee, sweetie. It's going to be a long day. Ensign Kim is going to put you through some hell.
Warp 5.
Alternate outcomes of the Zindi crisis.
But the Enterprise is heavily damaged. We're talking practically destroyed. Everything but a shell. Maybe the saucer section is the only thing that's still around. And 80% of the crew dies. Commentary, Trek Stars.
Rick Berman and Star Trek.
He's kind of a moving target, so he found some dimensionality. He made it into a cube.
Yeah.
And so he was able to move things around in there.
A poor cube.
Continuing mission.
Star Trek Equinox.
John Savage actually came up with the premise for the story, but they needed somebody to flesh it out, to develop it, and so they sent me John's premise, and I just, well, it expanded into the script for the project that we're doing.
Melodic Treks.
The Borg in Music.
When they released it as a Blu-ray,
and they combined them.
They connected them, and there's the no feature. Delay. They cut off that music, and then it's just like, oh, that didn't work.
Literary Treks.
Rise of the Federation, Tower of Babel.
Saval talks about this idea that, you know, people mutually consent to abide by these rules for their collective benefit. The idea that, you know, absolute unfettered freedom is just a ridiculous idea.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. You'll find them in a wide variety of places. We've got our shows out there now on iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn, a new source, Spreaker, where you can go and you can get the show through the Spreaker app, or you can stream it on the website. You can even take our shows and share them with other people on your own blogs now if you'd like. There's an embeddable player on Spreaker, and you'll also find us on TuneIn, on the Windows Phone directory, which goes to Xbox and Zune as well, or you can stream from our website. And if you're over in iTunes, be sure to check out our new home as well, where you'll find all of our content in one place with special groupings. In fact, Matthew, this week, yesterday, I just added a new grouping there on our artist page for Deep Space Nine, the final chapter, where we're collecting those special shows that you and I are doing on the Orb.
Oh, excellent. Oh, so good. I've been enjoying doing those so much. I think, Chris, every episode could probably be a two and a half hour episode if we let ourselves go.
It could. I mean, we just did Strange Bedfellows this past week, which is now available for everyone to listen to. And that was our longest orb ever. And we've done, 56 episodes of the orb now? 58 episodes, maybe? It's, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. I'm just glad, Chris, that you have not created a new sound effect for the old people loving that you've had to talk about quite a bit.
Oh, gosh. So Kai went into quiet. Yeah, I'll tell you what. So anyway, well, go check out all these shows, everyone, anyway, and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. Now, if you'd like to send us some feedback on today's show, on the sound of her voice, anything we talked about, news, or, you know, anything related to Star Trek, you can do that in a number of ways. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show. Choose the Ready Room. That will come to us by email. You can also send us a voicemail through the website. And you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the Ready Room, about anything related to Star Trek. There are lots of categories there for you to join into. And if social media is your thing, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username TrekFM. Now, Matthew, when you're not, you know, pouring your heart out to someone you've never met before, who's maybe 3 years in your past, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. Of course, you can find me on two shows here on the network, usually with you every week, Chris, doing Literary Treks about books and comics, where we are actually going to be picking up our retrospective on the DS9 relaunch. So very soon. So check that out. You can also find me on The Orb, as I mentioned, where we do talk nothing but Deep Space Nine all the time. You can also find me as well on my personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Now, Chris, when you're not following Quark around trying to find new ways nefariously trick people out of money, where can we find you?
I'm always trying to do that. You know, you can never have enough money or latinum.
That's true. It's very true.
Yeah. Well, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username and on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. Elsewhere on the network, besides doing Literary Treks and The Orb with you, Matthew, you can find me on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. You can find me on Matterstream, where I interview scientists and actors and creatives and writers and people about things that are inspired by Star Trek or loosely related to Star Trek. And then Continuing Mission, which I've already mentioned in the show today, which is about fan films, independent productions, and we're probably going to get into some games on there pretty soon as well. Before we let you go, we'd also like to remind you one more time about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice just for trying Audible as a Trek FM listener. Go to audibletrial.com/TrekFM and sign up and choose whatever book you want. Ashes of Eden, as Matthew told you about today during news, or anything. And if you decide at the end not to stick with Audible, remember, you get to keep that audiobook. So there's nothing to lose. But it really helps us keep the show coming to you every week. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. Check it out, audibletrial.com/TrekFM. Well, Matthew, it's been a great Ready Room this week. I really enjoyed finally having you on to talk DS9. I don't get enough DS9 with you on The Orb every week. So I'm glad you're here with me today. But I'm going to wander back down to the Irish wake because, you know, I want to pay my respects to Captain Kuzak as well. Plus, I've had enough of the synthahol. I need some of the real stuff.
Well, Chris, that sounds like a fantastic idea. And it's time to stick a delayed comm signal in it because the Ready Room is done. Recording. Oh, Odo's monthiversary pants.
Wonderful. Nice big waveforms.
Oh,
Yeah. If I lean in, things get different.
Mm. Wow, it just got saucy in here.
Mm. Cassidy Yates.
Oh, the way he says that is awesome. Just
Cassidy Yates.
Oh, God.